Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. On today's podcast, I had with me Ernst Rustenhoven. Ernst is a principal at Slingshot Ventures, a Dutch VC investing in the future of digital consumer life. On today's episode, we talked about having one toe rather than a whole foot in multiple ventures, why going faster isn't always better, why margins matter, and why up and to the right isn't always right when you are modeling out your business. This is a great episode, and you do not want to miss it. Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today with me via Zoom, I am really excited to have with me Ernst Rustenhoven. Ernst is principal at Slingshot Ventures, a Dutch VC investing in the future of digital consumer life, focused on B2B and B2B2C ventures, whilst actively helping founders accelerate their businesses with knowledge, experience, and international networks of people and companies. Ernst, really great to have you here with me today. And for our audience, if you want to learn more about Ernst's background, please do check out the primer episode, which was released earlier this week. But in the meantime, Ernst, great to have you here and looking forward to digging into some of this stuff.
Yeah, thanks, Arish, for having me. It's fun to talk about business and ventures and venture capital in general.
Yeah, for sure. So let's dive straight in. According to an article by The Next Web, which was released relatively recently, Amsterdam is currently the EU's leading ecosystem, though it also suggested headwinds in terms of difficulties in attracting talent, gaps in the funding environment, amongst others. But for our audience, many of whom won't really understand the Netherlands and the Dutch ecosystem, can you give us a rundown of where you think the ecosystem is and what some of the challenges as well as some of the opportunities are?
Yeah, it's there's probably too much to talk about to really give the right overview of the Amsterdam ecosystem within the time frame of this podcast. But one of the things I think is that the ecosystem has definitely matured. So there is a lot of tech activity, and we have some big international tech companies that have their headquarters here in Amsterdam. Booking, Uber EMEA, Netflix, etc. That attracts a lot of interesting talent, that when they don't want to work with these big corporates anymore, they tend to move to startups, found their own startups, join others. So that is a very good source of very interesting tech talent. Amsterdam is an amazing place to live. I think it is ranked continuously in the top three cities around the world for expats. So that helps a lot by attracting people. I think we have a strong ecosystem here in terms of knowledge, but we definitely have a lot of challenges to overcome. I think that if you look to the statistics, the Netherlands is lacking behind in terms of co-investing with investors from other countries, which is, I think, a bit strange, because the Dutch tend to be known for being very international and entrepreneurial. Also very open economy, so we tend to cooperate relatively easy, so that's definitely something that we can improve on. Also with respect to the financing gap, it is there. Also the last months, I think that we saw the largest dip in funding compared to all other European countries.
And is that funding gap at the earlier stages or later stages? Where would you suggest
it's predominantly sits? At the later stages, where also the hits are hardest. But it is basically everywhere. Dutch startups always tend to raise less across every round compared to their European peers in other countries. So it's something we need to fix. The Dutch market, if you look on it on a national level, obviously isn't as big as the UK or German market. So There's also maybe some reason for this because not every company is able to expand across borders. But I think our level of talent, the international approach of our people should be sufficient to build international startups. And I think the government should do more to support this. We have amazing universities, but if you look to the innovation spin out from these universities, it's also lacking behind other European countries. I think we don't have the right fiscal incentives to attract and retain top talent. So the whole stock option structure is very tax inefficient here. All these type of things don't really help the ecosystem. If you look to other like real tech hubs across the globe, the government does much more also in terms of capital and making available capital for early stage startups to support these startups. We have a big opportunity there as well. I mean, it is a challenge to convince the government to do so. But when the government sees the opportunity the way we do, then hopefully this will get better very soon.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of these things, especially where you're talking about state finance and state incentives, takes time, and it requires obviously lobbying and bodies, set up to ensure that the government understands the opportunities ahead and why this is like a long-term play. Obviously, in the UK, you know, we have things like the SEIS and the EIS scheme for early stage investment, where you have the tax efficiency for high net worth and angel investors. We have R&D tax credits. I would argue that we've gone backwards a little bit, obviously, in the UK post-Brexit. It's slightly harder to find talent. It's slightly harder to secure kind of the capital that used to be. And equally, there's also been, some backward steps in terms of some of those incentives, albeit that actually at SEIS, for example, that's been lifted by an additional 100,000 allowance. It strikes me that in Holland, I've been looking at this a little bit because one of my daughters will be, reaching university age in a few years. She is, my wife is Italian, so she holds, Italian citizenship as well. And we're actually considering, looking at Dutch universities, which also have English language curriculums, which is a massive, bonus in terms of attracting, as you say, talent and bringing more people into the country. I think as with pretty much every country, right, it's balancing out what the domestic requirements are versus, the value that is placed on the ecosystems. I'm guessing, with the upsurge of all the technology that we're seeing in terms of AI, et cetera, governments are paying a hell of a lot more attention today. Moving on a little bit, I just want to go take a step backwards. Obviously, in the primer episode, you talked a lot about how you got into Slingshot, into venture. But, you had a brief career in education, in corporate finance, and also in operating, right, before you moved into investing and into venture, where you've been for half a decade or more now. So what was it for you, right, that made you take that leap, make that journey from operator to investor? What was it that really drove you? Because you talked about it as having one toe but not one foot in the game, but which I think is a great metaphor.
Yeah,
it'd be really good to understand.
I mean, I've been super privileged, I think, all my life, and I always had the chance of doing what I love doing. So I was an ambitious student. I studied art and then eventually thought, okay, what are the most transformative parts in the lifetime of a company? And I thought, okay, that's probably M&A, buying and selling companies, for a founder to sell his or her baby to a new owner. That's a really big part of the journey of a company and an entrepreneur. So I thought, okay, so that should be the coolest thing out there. And then I started working in M&A, and then I actually found out that a lot of companies are, not to be disrespectful, but relatively boring. And the ones that I really liked were the ones that were innovative, young, ambitious entrepreneurs, and were also, as a young person, you can add a lot of value relatively quickly because you know the market, you have a skill set that is specific, something that entrepreneurs need in a specific part of their journey. So that's why I started working with these type of entrepreneurs just a lot more. I got to know many of them. And then in your M&A career, you also try to build a network to bring business yourself to the firm. Then eventually I had the chance to join one of these companies, which I thought in that time in my career was the most fun thing to do. And like I told before, it also started a little bit to feel uncomfortable, always being on the sideline, always advising CEOs and founders what to do and never having done it myself or not even having worked within a company myself and as an operator. So I thought, okay, this is a perfect time for me to learn these new skills, to be responsible for the things I think of, and to make sure they happen. And when it doesn't turn out the way I want it to be, I need to fix it. And so that was really, really a good experience. I think more from an intellectual perspective, it's just very cool to see so many companies and to every time have to think about what is the thing that makes this company unique? What is the market structure? What should make this company defensible in the future? What do I need to look at specifically to this company to find out whether this is a good company in its specific market with its specific value proposition? And to me, that's intellectually challenging, and that's one of the things I really like. And for me, venture capital brings many of the best elements of business together. It's analytical, it's entrepreneurial, you need to be socially strong, you need to be a network builder, you basically need to know something about every aspect of a business, from strategy to finance to tech to marketing to HR. It's a very complete job or profession. Maybe after entrepreneurship, the most complete one. So if there's ever something I want to do after having done VC, it's probably entrepreneurship itself, because that's probably the only thing that's more complete compared to VC.
But equally, and just listening, you know, listening to you, it kind of like stirs up a lot of emotion with myself, because like all the things you describe are the things I love. And I think that comes from being quite a intellectually curious generalist, right? So I think the difference is, having been an entrepreneur myself for many, many years, one of the things with entrepreneurship is after a while it becomes a fairly repetitive. In fact, the best businesses are businesses with repetitive or repeatable processes or replicable processes, right? So then you get into kind of a steady state of building. Whereas I guess investing, you're constantly challenging yourself with something new. You don't get necessarily hugely deep into anything, but it allows you to kind of spread that knowledge or understand more about different verticals, different businesses, different types of businesses and business models. And actually, one of the questions I guess I had for you as well, you know, we were just talking about this earlier, is why consumer? What is it about consumer that really excites you?
Yeah, I mean, just as a human being, I think the fact that you can actually see and touch the things that you invest in, and the fact that people have an opinion about the products and the services that you invest in, because they have a impact on the everyday lives of people. You can either like it, you cannot like it, you can see a trend and believe in it, and have an opinion on it, and other people view it very differently. So it's very, it speaks to the imagination of many people. I also like to think about the change in consumer behavior. So what people are doing right now and how they will live their lives in, let's say, 10 years from now, and what will be important, and to anticipate on that change. And I mean, whilst B2B SaaS investments can probably be a very cool thing to do as well, to me as a consumer investor, it's much more of the same. So it's much more looking at your Excel spreadsheet, looking at all the metrics, and then basically on the metrics deciding whether something is, whether a business is good or not, which doesn't mean that we don't look to metrics, but consumer factors have this intangible thing, like the X factor.
There's that emotional connection with the business.
Exactly, right? Yeah. Exactly. Something that sets it apart from all the others that are maybe doing exactly the same, that maybe have better margins, that maybe even have a better team. But there is this one thing that you cannot grasp that you believe will make this company a superstar. Hopefully our team is relatively good at finding those companies and finding that X factor.
Yeah, I mean, I completely get it. As someone who's probably the other side, so I find it easier to look at SaaS businesses or more traditional software businesses, because again, to your point, right, you can look at the metrics, you can understand what's happening, you can envisage maybe the market. I think to your point with consumer businesses, understanding what that X factor is very much part gut, part, you know, part experience, part metrics. And as someone who is not a massive consumer myself, I guess maybe I would need to look to my daughters to figure out what the next big thing is, rather than looking at it myself. But look, you also wrote an article back at the tail end of 2022, and you wrote about 10 lessons that you'd learned over the last 5 years as a VC. One of my favorites amongst them is number 6, right? Going faster isn't always better, which has definitely not been the mantra amongst VCs for almost a decade, I think, right? But has started to change. What led you to take that contrarian view, at least at the time? And, you know, how should founders think about this?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of my strongest beliefs about building solid and core profitable businesses. I saw it both before my time in VC and as well during my time in VC, that as soon as a company receives investment, it starts hiring a lot of people. Yeah. Very fast. And I know that I hear a lot of people online saying you need to hire as fast as possible. Yeah, I mean, you can do that. Well, one thing I know is that you hire a lot of people and then you will have a shakeout.
Yeah.
And that shakeout is very costly. And it can also kill companies, because preserving that culture along the growth journey is a very difficult thing to do. And if you go too fast, I believe that doing that is very difficult, and it's both very capital inefficient.
Mm-hmm. Well, people are the most expensive cost in any business, right? Ultimately.
Yeah, exactly. And not to mention the fact that if you have a product that is maybe not perfect yet, or a service, or maybe even bad, then it would be even worse. Mm-hmm. Is that when you make that company bigger and you scale it very hard, you amplify the problem. And so the problem becomes exponentially bigger. And one of the core beliefs I have is that when you make that a exponentially bigger problem, the only short-term solution to fixing the problem is hiring more people, which then amplifies the long-term problem. So sometimes you need to consolidate. You need to think, okay, what will be my biggest bottleneck, my biggest obstacle to scaling from here? And do I need to take time to fix that, to make my operation scalable again, to ensure that when, let's say, 100,000 consumers work with my product, it still works. And if you need time to do that, take that time, because it will be the death of your company if you don't do that, because it will be a problem you can't fix anymore. So that's why we believe that this is a better way to build a company. And we want to see companies that in the end can be EBITDA positive and EBITDA on an EBITDA level, very profitable. Because whatever happens, I know that we can then sell the company on an EBITDA multiple, which will always generate a return for us.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think what's really interesting for me is, you know, you said it right at the beginning there. Often, I think when founders raise, especially when they raise venture, there is almost this pressure to spend, right? Which has slowed down a little bit now. And obviously we're now in a place where people are talking about, you know, 24, 36 month runways, which again, I think are problematic, right? There is a balance to be struck between spending too quickly, but not spending quickly enough, because ultimately the reason to raise venture is to accelerate growth. But there are efficient ways of accelerating growth. And I see it all the time, again, where, you know, teams hire more engineers, or they hire, especially in sort of B2B businesses, hire lots of salespeople without actually necessarily thinking about, well, what is the sales process that we have in place that is going to give these guys work to do? You know, there's this assumption, if I bring on an additional salesperson, that will lead to an additional X in sales, which is just, you know, well, fantasy for the most part, right?
No, I agree. And sometimes, especially for B2B companies, I mean, it makes sense to really build a good product. And maybe you need to invest a lot of money in technology first before you can actually go to market. But for many consumer businesses, that's not often the case. You just have to grow your business in the core profitably. It is even more relevant to consumer businesses than it is to B2B businesses, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, look, later on in the season, we're going to have Maya Mufarak on. Maya was CMO at Pharmacy to You, so she scaled, you know, that kind of consumer pharma business. And one of the questions I'm definitely going to have for her, but I'd love to pose it to you as well in this whole kind of topic of scaling, is obviously, again, one of the main uses of venture funds has been to juice up your marketing, right? But we're in a very different landscape again. Acquisition costs are becoming more expensive. Everyone is essentially bidding for the same part of the consumer wallet, right? Like it's no longer a case of, you know, if you are selling, I don't know, a widget, you are only competing against other widget companies. You're actually competing against everyone who is buying ad spend, right? Or has ad spend. So how do you think about kind of marketing in consumer businesses? You know, is it better for them to throw that money into kind of brand and, to your point, build that X factor? Or is digital acquisition still, you know, a very important part of the landscape there?
Oh, it is still a very important part of the landscape, and probably that won't change. I mean, if you don't do paid acquisition, you are leaving money on the table.
Sure.
But on the other hand, I saw a lot of businesses who only relied on paid acquisition, and that is definitely not the way going forward.
Yeah.
So in my opinion, starting a consumer business, with all respect to all founders doing that, is relatively easy. So basically everybody nowadays can start their own web shop and sell a product. And the whole drop shipping trend, etc., has shown that it's not so difficult to do that. But if you don't have the right margins, then you are not able to compete online, because basically you are not adding enough value. You're just transferring good from A to B.
Yeah.
And that's not really adding a lot of value to our society. But really good companies are still able to acquire customers at solid customer acquisition costs.
Mm-hmm.
And if you then combine that with a very diversified marketing strategy, not relying too much on one channel, not going too big into one channel very fast, then I think for many consumer companies that really have a good value proposition, you are able to build a company with a solid marketing mix with acceptable customer acquisition costs. And especially the companies that are nailing this right now, in my opinion, are the ones that do their whole influencer marketing strategy right.
Yeah.
And ensure that they can scale it. Because if you do that right, right now it's still very cost attractive. So hopefully I'm not awakening a lot of companies here, and the ones who do it right, I hopefully they come to me now. But I mean, that is so important for a consumer brand, because you can scale it. It's relatively cheap, and it's actively building your fan base and your community that eventually will lead to unpaid retention. And that's where, of course, the magic happens.
Yeah, it's that holy grail of virality, retention, and getting to almost sort of positive, you know, positive CAC payback, essentially, over time, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, what's interesting just in this conversation is I think we've talked quite a lot about kind of fairly, you know, what a lot of founders would consider relatively boring and, you know, financial kind of metrics. But these are the really key parts of any business that you've got to understand. You and I have some pretty similar old school views about the fundamentals, it sounds like, of running a business, whether it's venture scale or not. You wrote a piece about financial modeling in LinkedIn. On LinkedIn, which is like incredibly dear to my heart. But what are the things that you see founders get wrong all the time when they're modeling out their business? And do you think there are specific complexities in consumer ventures that founders need to think about slightly differently or pay special consideration to?
Yeah. I mean, this is fun, of course, because we've been talking about this before, and I know this is one of your core topics as well. So with respect to modeling, I see a couple of things happening, and that is that people just start forecasting, and in the end, it doesn't really make sense. So what I want to see is a financial model and an entrepreneur that thinks about his business in terms of unit economics, then tying the unit economics to the P&L, and then eventually from the P&L, and I mean, if you're a bit further away, also the balance sheet, mm-hmm. forecast the funding need, and then also tie back their own revenue generation to the whole sum mm-hmm. Calculations. So it needs to be aligned. I see companies that come to us trying to raise 10 million, but if you look to the financial model, there's no funding need because they believe they will be profitable from day one. So yeah, my big question would be, why do you need
the money?
Exactly. I also see companies that make, let's say, 2.4 billion in revenues in 2027. I mean, we now live in 2023. I think it's pretty difficult to get to that revenue amount within 4 years for pretty much every company out there. And then if I look to the market size, it's they realize more revenue than the market. So these are very basic mistakes. But in the early stages, these are the mistakes that you see. And it tells me that they're just trying to make the story look good. And yeah, that's not a founder I want to talk to be honest. I want a founder that has a good story and an honest story.
Yeah, it's that whole thing about, you know, the hockey stick up and to the right, and up and to the right isn't always right, right? And again, having built many of these models myself, like it's always this balance between, okay, yes, let's show reasonable growth and ambitious growth, but let's also not be completely stupid. And again, it's whether you do it top down and versus bottom up, right? Like it's figuring out actually, what can I actually achieve in the market rather than, well, if I throw enough money, you know, if I assume my CAC costs remain constant for the next 20 years, then, you know, essentially I will be, or the, you know, based on like the 5 days of ad spend that we've spent, you know, I'm now going to extrapolate that my low acquisition costs are going to remain for the rest of the business life. You know, and therefore model on that basis. And for consumer businesses, I mean, what are the really important things that you would want to see in those models?
Yeah, well, to be honest, I don't think it's much different than to the things I would like to see in a B2B business, although obviously I'm not an expert in the latter one. But I want to have a feeling with respect to the key drivers of a business.
Yeah.
So it starts on the top of your conversion funnel, down to your conversion funnel, and all the metrics that matter there. So AOV, conversion rate, Customer acquisition cost, preferably stripped down by channel and by country, and then ensuring that you model your first-time customers, you model your returning customers, so I can also see whether the whole development of the margin generation from these type of customers adds back to the CLV to CAC calculation that's in there. And if you do that right, then I think you're pretty much on the right track.
Yeah. And I think the takeaway from there is you need to be granular enough that you can defend each and, well, that you have thought about and can defend each of those assumptions, right? Because again, the more you abstract away from all of that, the easier it is to punch holes, because you are basically losing the nuance of, maybe there is a cohort of 10% of your customers that come on board every month that you know are going to churn. But if you actually just assume an 80% retention rate or 90% retention rate or whatever, it doesn't track through in the financial model. That's potentially not a great example, but it's essentially it's about being able to get into the detail enough that shows that you understand your business, but equally and that you've thought deeply about it, but equally that you're able to then change some of those modeling parameters so that you can see, well, what if our retention rate drops, what if our price increases, what if we add a new product line in, or what if CAC changes, right?
Fully agree. So you need to be able to show some sensitivity to run some scenario analysis relatively easy. So don't build a jumbo jet financial model. It's so early days. I mean, it's not very relevant, but make sure it is compact and that you can play with the key variables, but you can also track and report on the key variables. And maybe last point about this topic, I don't know if the people like us to talk about financial models for the whole podcast, but one of the things that I really like that you talked about first is you shouldn't project this mega hockey stick, because what if an investor buys it? An investor invests based on his hockey stick, then you have to start delivering on this hockey stick, and that's a lot harder. So you will basically be behind from day one. And that's not going to be the relationship you want to manage. You want to have an investor that is also willing to follow on because you deliver to the promise.
Yeah, and hopefully even beat it. So no, 100%. I think maybe we should wrap up on the financial modeling side. Otherwise, I could get sidetracked for a long time. But look, just as we wrap up, the podcast is called Nothing Ventured, right? And it's called Nothing Ventured for a reason. It's about backing yourself. It's about taking those first steps into building something unique. For folk that are getting into venture, into VC right now, how should they think about the shifting landscape? And where should they focus their energies when they start running a fund? Because I know that's something that you're quite involved in at Slingshot as well.
I think that first of all, people coming out of university, they should have multiple options, because analyst positions within VC aren't increasing right now. And it's becoming much harder to get into VC than, let's say, the last 2-3 years. I mean, if you are an operator right now wanting to make the move at the switch to VC later on in your career, I think there are still possibilities. But of course, it makes a lot of sense to look for a fund that matches your skills and experience. In my opinion, the venture model is relatively clear. You need to build a portfolio that's big enough to maximize the chance for having outliers. And probably it won't work to only look for companies within your own country to get to those outliers. So it's probably already starting to be an international strategy very soon from a certain fund size. And then, to no more than one. And you want to manage the risk of your portfolio. So it makes a lot of sense to invest together. Mm-hmm. So what we are doing and what I am doing personally, of course, is investing in my network, investing in potential partners to co-invest with, to share good deal flow with, and preferably with partners that are complementary to Slingshot, because they are in another geography, because let's say, take each again, the example that I talked about earlier. I mean, we bring the consumer angle to the table, but it's clearly a food tech business as well.
Yeah.
So I would like to co-invest with an investor that knows a lot about food tech and also maybe other parts of the value chain. And then we bring the consumer knowledge to the table. So I think that that is the type of deals that you want to do. And that means talking a lot to people, going out there, traveling, networking, getting content out, make sure that everybody knows what you are doing. And preferably thinks you are a good investor within your specific area.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. And I think the main takeaway there is, you know, landscape has shifted. Things are not as easy as they were necessarily, you know, build those networks, build those relationships, whether it's for today or whether it's for 6 months or 6 years down the track. You know, hopefully if you invest in those relationships, you know, you can build from there. Ernst, it's been absolutely wonderful having you here on the podcast with me today. For our listeners, where's the best place for them to find you online? Are you on LinkedIn? Are you on Twitter? Where is the best place for them to find you?
Yeah, they can contact me on LinkedIn. I'm not really a Twitter guy. I publish an article once in a while on LinkedIn, but these snappy messages are not really for me. I love these types of conversations. So a little bit more content, a little bit more deep diving. But yeah, happy to talk to anyone who is interested in our space, who is interested in potentially working together, who has an amazing startup within the consumer area that might fit with our fund. Yeah, so please feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn.
Incredible. Ernst, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time today. It's been wonderful talking to you.
Thank you, Arish.